Good morning, and thank you very much for coming to the first session of our four-part series, The Jew of the Future. We'll be talking today about, as you see on your sheets, the new fertility, also known as, can a Jew have three mothers? There are source sheets on the table over there. There's also a sheet with the list of those who signed up, those who actually registered in advance. If your name is not there, please make sure that you add your name at the end, because that way, first of all, it helps just in general planning the space. You know, we planned for the 60 people who registered, although I had a feeling that there were some people who had not. Just a feeling. But also because those of you who have been here before are aware, I like to send out emails in advance with the source sheets and emails afterwards with a link to the audio recording. So if you sign up, then you will receive that. So please do. For those who have not been at a class in this building before, a couple of notes. First of all, thank you for contending with the parking. It is worse than usual this summer because of work they're doing on the building, which is taking up some of the spots. I apologize. By now, since you're here, you know at least one entrance into the building. There is a wheelchair-accessible entrance. Unfortunately, it wasn't unlocked early enough. Today, it will be, God willing, starting with next week, but that's out this door here. So anyone who wants one when leaving, that will take you out into the parking lot on the side, in the parking lot. So that's there. The other entrance, of course, out there. I feel like a flight attendant. Out there to the right. And then also the far entrance is down there to the left. But there are also washrooms. There are women's washrooms on this side. There's one that's wheelchair accessible right outside this door, and then there's another one up the steps a little further down. Right. No, the buzzer at the wheelchair entrance does not work. That is, but it's unlocked, so you don't need to buzz. Right, it was. Now it's unlocked. And I have no control over the air conditioning. I apologize. If you are too cold, if you are too hot, you balance each other out. I know that there are people who are too cold. I know there are people who are too hot, and this is just what we deal with. Okay. So, our topic for this morning, right? Can a Jew have three mothers? Right? A Jew never has enough mothers. But this is part of Jew of the future. And the truth of the matter is, in some countries, as we'll find out, it's the Jew of today. It is spreading. What this is about is a technique that is meant to eliminate genetically transmitted diseases, fatal diseases, in fact, but it involves the introduction of genetic material from two women, and potentially you can create an embryo and implant it in a third woman. And then the question is going to be, from a Jewish standpoint, who is the mother? That's really where we're going with this. There are more chairs. There are chairs, and people can also move chairs. I am actually happy, though, that everyone's on this side of the room. Some years you get people sitting back here, and that becomes hard for me to see. So thank you for sitting on this side. But if you... Sorry? Absolutely. Absolutely. The issue of who is a Jew is very much a part of this. What happens if there are three mothers and two of them are Jewish? Right? The third is not. Or two of them are not Jewish. Whatever, you know, scenario you want to come up with. Take a look at source number one, please, on your sheets. Rabbi J. David Blythe is a phenomenal, prolific, and clear writer on many, many issues, principally issues of Jewish law, though not exclusively. And he deals a lot with new technology, new discoveries. So he gives us here a very convenient digest of the science we're talking about. Mitochondria are bean-shaped organelles present in every cell of the human body. Mitochondria are analogous to batteries in the sense that they power the cells of all complex life forms by converting glucose into energy. Inside of the inside of every cell in your body is something that needs to actually take sugar and turn it into energy. But one thing that they need is oxygen. Cessation of respiration cuts off oxygen from the mitochondria. Lack of oxygen prevents the mitochondria from converting nutrients into energy. They need oxygen in order to be able to power your body. That's how the battery, so to speak, works. Lack of energy, in turn, causes the cell to cease functioning, leads to the end result, death. Now, where do you get your mitochondria from? Mitochondria are present in the cytoplasm of the female ovum and are passed on from mother to child. So your mitochondria are in the egg of the mother. Mitochondria contain their own DNA. Oh, that's what I forgot to mention. Please make sure to silence your phones. Thanks for the reminder. The mitochondria have their own DNA. Separate from the DNA that you have in the cells in your body, the mitochondria have their own DNA. 37 genes are present in the mitochondrial DNA, passed directly from a woman's ovum into every cell of her progeny. So, your mother provides you with your DNA that are in their cells that are merged with the DNA from the father, but separately, the mitochondrial DNA, which are necessary for your body to be able to function, come exclusively from the mother. The father has nothing to do with it. That's right. All of the women here already knew this. All of the men here are working on digesting this idea. But it is true. That which powers every cell in your body comes from your mother. That's the way it works. The problem is this. What happens if there is a disease in the mitochondrial DNA? It's going to be transmitted from the mother into the child, and because her cells, in this regard, her mitochondria, are not joining with the husband's, whatever the mother has is going to the child. There's no opportunity for the merging of hers with her husband's and potentially weeding something out. That's not going to work. Whatever she has is going into the child, barring mutation. So that what they've come up with is a method to deal with a situation in which there is in fact a disease in the mother's mitochondrial DNA, and the solution is to have the mitochondria taken from somebody else and put into her egg. And that way you have her genetic material in general, and you'll have the husband's genetic material as well, fertilizing the egg, right? But the mitochondria will be from this other woman, this other person. That's what we're dealing with here. So continuing in number one, total mitochondria replacement results in an embryo having mitochondrial DNA derived entirely from the donor, while the nuclear DNA, the regular DNA in the nucleus of the cell, is entirely that of the recipient mother and the male from whom the sperm has been obtained. So the kid is getting regular DNA from the mother, regular DNA from the father, and mitochondrial DNA from a donor. Fertilization of manipulated ova resulted in manifestation of many genetic abnormalities. Rabbi Bleich points out that, like with all new techniques, certainly in the realm of reproduction, you get problems. It isn't smooth, and certainly in the early going. You get genetic abnormalities, but seemingly normal embryonic stem cell lines could be extracted in a significant percentage of ova fertilized by that method. They are able to come up with, and he was writing this about 2012-2013 technology, things have advanced since then, they are able to produce embryos that actually can then be implanted and carried to term. Yeah? Oh, you'll get to it. Don't worry about it. Hang in there. Hang in there. So, in truth, there are arguments against doing this sort of, I don't know what to call it, procedure. There are arguments against it. Many countries outlaw it currently due to risk. So if you're looking at your sheet in source number 2, you find an FDA advisory in the United States. In the United States, it is currently not legal to engage in this. Can't do it in the U.S. because of safety concerns. In number 3, you find the government of Canada, a decree from 2014, and as far as I know, still active, it's still on Canada.ca, in which we are told that in Canada as well, you would not be allowed to replace defective mitochondrial DNA in a woman's eggs. On the other hand, in Israel, it is legal. In Israel, this can be done, and in fact, it is done. In source number 4, I brought you a paper which mentions this as well. I'm skipping over reading these aloud, but you have it on your sheets. It is indeed legal in Israel. There are other concerns besides the risk element of it, right? You're creating ambiguous maternity, which Judaism tends to avoid. We like the idea of a clear identification of parents, a clear identification of the family unit. It raises a fascinating question legally, a question of how you define adultery. Right? Consider that. Meaning, this question will come up with surrogacy also. But in this case, imagine that you have the husband's sperm, the wife's egg, but genetic material now, the mitochondria, are coming from somebody else. So you're producing a child via material from someone who is not part of the marriage. Now, you could respond, there's no act going on between them, and therefore this is not a concern, but it shouldn't be taken as a given, and some have argued that this is considered adulterous. And yes, they'll have the same problem with the sperm donor who's not the husband, they'll have the same problem in other cases as well, but it is something worth considering here. Stephen?
Who is the Jew?
That's where we're going. Believe it or not, we do have questions like that. However, even though there are those who disagree with this type of procedure because of the risk to the embryos you're creating. And keep in mind, we're not just talking about problems in the embryo right now. We don't know yet. We don't have enough data to know what's going to happen with these people 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the line, or with the children they create. So that's a huge issue of risk. There are, despite the objections, Rabbi Bleich points out in source number 5, you need to deal with this as a practical issue because, as he quotes, in technology, whatever can be done will be done, regardless of moral reservations on the part of some. He may not like it, he's opposed to the procedure, but the reality is, it is going to happen. And so we get to source number 6, which is our fundamental question. Here's our case. Sarah's DNA is merged with Rebecca's mitochondria and implanted in Rachel's uterus. And the question now is, who is the mother? What are your options in this case? Who could be the mother? Sarah is one, right? It's her egg. Who else? Rachel could be the mother. Why? Because the baby is carried to term in her womb. Rebecca could be the mother because it's her mitochondrial DNA without which the baby would not live. What else is the option? All three, or some combination thereof. Why should we be narrow? Maybe the answer is, they're all the mother. Right? And then what do you do with the question that has now been put forth of who is the mother, who is Jewish? Right? What if, in our situation, Sarah and Rebecca are Jewish and Rachel is not Jewish? Right? What do you do? There's another option, by the way, for determining who is the mother. Right? I thought about doing this as a multiple choice thing on the on the sheets. You can have Sarah the egg donor. You can have Rebecca the mitochondria donor. You could have Rachel the woman who carries the baby to term. You could say that it is more than one. You could also say that it is none. Maybe to be the mother halachically, you have to do all the jobs. Right? Because that's the way it is in life. But maybe, in fact, you're the mother if you provide the genetic material, you carry the child to term, and otherwise, from the standpoint of Jewish law, there's no mother. I keep thinking of that bird that's going around in the story, are you my mother? Trying to figure out what its mother is. So maybe it's none of the above. Right? Maybe we have to be strict because we don't know. And maybe what that means is, in a scenario like ours, let's say Sarah and Rebecca are Jewish and Rachel is not Jewish, maybe we should say that the baby is going to need conversion to Judaism just in case, because we don't know the status of the baby, right? I mean, this is one of those issues where you're going to try to look back in traditional Jewish text for precedent, and you're going to break your head trying to find something, and we'll see the attempts. You'll see what we're talking about. This is complicated, and it's not just a question of Jewish status. There's more to the question.
Who do you send a card to on Mother's Day?
No, beyond that, there are other serious questions. Whom can you marry? Can you imagine this problem? This is not a small problem, because there are laws about arayot, of incestuous relationships. Can you imagine? Everyone is going to need a document that says where their mitochondria came from if you're going to say that the donor of the mitochondria is the mother, because now you have to make sure that the person you're dating is not your sister. Right? Because they come from the woman who gave the mitochondria. Oh boy. This gets incredibly challenging. What in the world do you do? So, in the course of our hour, which is now down to 45 minutes, I'm not going to be able to walk through every possibility and every source on this. That's not what this is designed for. I did give you a link in source number 7. To a longer class that I taught on a different technological issue which intersects with this, and that's the issue of the artificial uterus. Right? Because that's a technology that is coming eventually. It's not tomorrow, but it's decades down the road, but it's not centuries down the road. There are already advances when there was a story with sheep a couple of years ago where they had extremely, extremely premature sheep and they grew them in what is essentially a bag. Yeah. And there were pictures of it in the paper and so on. So you know it's true, right? But the question comes up there as well. The question of, so who exactly is a mother? How do you define maternity? So I gave a class on that, and if you go there, you can hear more of the ideas than we're going to get to today. So in order to address this, first of all, we have to ask two questions about what our options are. Besides the option of Sarah, the egg donor, and Rebecca, the mitochondria donor, and Rachel, who is the one who carries the baby to term, the question of, can you really say that there are multiple mothers? Could that really be an option that we'll say that there are multiple mothers? That's one question. And then second, opposite end, can you say that there are no mothers, that no one actually qualifies as the mother? So, Rabbi Usher Weiss is the halachic authority for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Israel. And he has to deal with this on a practical level, because as I said, this is legal in Israel. So if you take a look at source number 8, this is my translation from an article of his on the topic. Gave you the link for anyone who wants to see more of the article. That actually has an English summary on that page also, for those who won't read his Hebrew, but there's English on that page as well. He says, in truth, the main force of my argument comes from what seems clear and obvious in my eyes, that it is halakhically impossible to have two mothers, just as one cannot have two fathers. If it is this one, it is not that one. He says, one mother per customer. Now, he only means halakhic. He's not talking about families with a divorce or whatever. That's not what he's saying. But he's saying that the definition of maternity is exclusive. The definition of paternity is exclusive. One per customer. That's the argument that Rabbi Weiss makes. And he makes the argument as a matter of logic. Not a source-based, text-based argument. But it is simply, he says, this must be true. It's basic. However, not everybody agrees. Rabbi J. David Blank thinks that that's not true. And he brings you a source from the Talmud in source number 9. I'm going to explain the source before we see it in the text. He's talking about a man by the name of Goliath, or in English, Goliath, right? Goliath, the oversized Philistine who falls to David's slingshot. That's the one. The text introduces him as Ish HaBeinayim. Ish HaBeinayim is a strange phrase. It could mean the man from among the camp, from the word Bain. But the Talmud offers you a very interesting, if somewhat odd, suggestion for what Ish HaBeinayim means. And that's what I brought you here in number 9, the Gemara. The Talmud quotes Rabbi Yochanan as saying he was the son of 100 fathers and one mother. Now, the usual way that that is explained is that it is trying to cast aspersions on his mother and his father's morality. This was a woman who was with many males, and it's trying to tell you about the nature of the Philistines, right? You think of the way the word Philistine is used today. It's casting aspersions on the character of the mother. And that's the way that classic commentators read that line in the Talmud, except there was a period in Jewish history, roughly speaking, 12th, 13th, 14th century, in which there were great writers, great rabbinic writers in Western Europe who collectively put together sets of commentaries on the Talmud. Those commentaries are called Tosafot, additions, things that are added to the Talmud. And they became the authorities for much of early Ashkenazi law. Much of Ashkenazi practice derives from the rulings of the authors of these Tosafot commentaries to the Talmud. So Rabbi Bleich in source number 9 quotes them, and they says it's not what they were saying there about the paternity of Goliath. Third line in number 9. According to Tosafot, Goliath's paternity was not a matter of speculation or indeterminacy. It's not that she had many lovers and we don't know who the father is of Goliath. There were 100 men, and you know, one of them was the father, we don't know whom. No. His father, or better, his fathers were readily identifiable. Each of his mother's consorts was quite literally his father. In other words, her egg was fertilized by more than one man. That's what Tosafot thinks is going on. Lest you say to me, that's nonsense biologically, you would be incorrect. If you take a look at source number 10, where I wrote, yes, it can, I gave you a link to an article on CNN's website from February of this year, a case in which, indeed, there were twins born, and indeed, the egg had been fertilized by more than one sperm. Yes. It can happen. The term is sesquizygotic twins. I was going to put that in the line, but then it was going to run over, and I didn't want that, so it's not there. But sesquizygotic twins can happen. Yes, it is strange. Yes, it is exceedingly rare. However, what Tosafot is talking about is, in fact, biologically possible. Yes, I know. We all learned in school in biology, once the egg is fertilized, that's it. No more can get in. And that's generally speaking true, but not 100%. But that's not even the point. Go back to source number 9 and the footnote there. In number 9, I'm quoting from my Black's footnote at the bottom of source number 9. Tosafot's analysis, even if rejected as empirically incorrect, even if you tell me that it's not true and you can't have more than one male involved, that's not the point. The science of it is not the point. It is significant because it reflects Tosafot's willingness to entertain halachic recognition of two fathers. The fact is, Tosafot doesn't look at that. I'm going to have to proceed here with this. I'm sorry not to take that many questions, but there's a lot to talk about. The fact is that the Tosafot commentary doesn't react to this and say, well, that's impossible, we never recognize multiple fathers in Judaism. He's okay with the idea of having multiple fathers. Now, the truth is, you could argue this point, you could argue this read of Tosafot, you could say Tosafot is saying biological fathers, yes, but halachic fathers, no, we will decide that one of them is the father and not more than one. You could make that argument. Nonetheless, Rabbi Bleich brings that to say there can be more than one father, and therefore he says there can also be more than one mother. But what they're trying to do is instructive. They're taking this brand new situation of genetic material involving more than one person plus a separate woman carrying the baby to term, and they're trying to apply 2,000-year-old texts to derive principles that somehow we're going to be able to apply here. That's the attempt, and this is the way halacha works. Sometimes you throw up your hands and you say, I got nothing. But before you do that, you exhaust every source to say what might be relevant here. Others make the argument differently to say that there can be more than one mother. So, for example, source number 11, Rabbi Moshe Sternbach says, Of course you can have more than one mother. He says, in my humble opinion, he was a rabbi from South Africa. He lived in South Africa for many years. I think he's in Israel now. In my humble opinion, one could contend that since the two women cause the formation and development of the child in the end, and one cannot have one without the other, there is room to say that both have the status of mother, and the child has two mothers, and that's just the way it goes. They honor your father and your mother and your mother. That's the way you'll have to do it. And he quotes you that Tosfot that said that it seems to say you could have more than one father. So this is one debate. Can you really say that there is more than one mother? The answer is some believe no. Rabbi Asher Weiss, a very big voice in medical halacha in Israel today, says no. However, some very prominent voices disagree and say no, we would recognize that, we're open-minded, it can be. What about the possibility that there could be no mother by Jewish law? Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg was the rabbi of a synagogue that was across the street from Shaarei Tzedek Hospital for many, many years. He passed away in 2003, I think. And he answered many questions for the doctors there for decades and was also very big authority in Jewish medical ethics. And he said, not in this case, because he passed away in 2003. He didn't know about mitochondrial DNA replacement as a practical thing. But he dealt with the basic issue of surrogacy. Right? The question where you have an egg from one woman and it's implanted in the uterus of another woman. So he dealt with that question, and he made the argument, which Rabbi Bleich quotes in source number 12. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg in his Tzitz Eliezer collection of responsa has advanced the novel view that in the eyes of halacha, a child born of in vitro fertilization, not even where it's two mothers, actually not surrogacy, just IVF in general, has neither a father nor a mother, even if the biological mother and the gestational mother are one and the same, as is the case in the majority of instances in which in vitro procedures are employed. Rabbi Waldenberg's arguments, which are not based upon cited precedents or analogy to other halachic provisions, are three in number. The first one is the one that we're going to bring here. Fertilization in the course of IVF occurs in an unnatural manner through the intermediacy of a third power, extraneous to the father or mother, i.e. the petri dish. Right, the medium in which you first grow the zygote and turn it into an embryo in the opening days before it is implanted, he says, once you involve this third agent, there's no true father, there's no true mother. Rabbi Bleich thought that's really interesting, but no way. As we continue in number 12, I heard a corroborating voice over here. Is that Pearl? Oh, Sandy, okay. To this writer, those arguments appear to be without substance. In response to the first argument, it must be stated the petri dish is not a third power and in no way contributes biologically or chemically to the fertilization process. It is simply a convenient receptacle designed to provide a hospitable environment in which fertilization may occur. So he disagrees. He says it's not true. But it's a fascinating question, right? Can you say there's no mother because there's an outside agent that in fact was involved? So how are we going to deal with this? We've got 33 minutes to go. How in the world are we going to solve this problem, which, again, Jew of the future, but in Israel, Jew of today? There are people walking around who have benefited from this procedure. So, what is their status? So I think what you need to do is look at three different models of pregnancy. How do I understand what Jewish law is perceiving going on in the case of pregnancy? And it will have to lead us to an answer of whether genetic material is the essence, or gestation is the essence, or for that matter, according to one possibility, birth is the essence. We haven't talked about the possibility, which isn't currently done, but God willing, at some point in the future will be, which is the ability to take a fetus out of a woman who is pregnant where the pregnancy is in trouble for some reason that needs to be halted, and then put into somebody else. It could be the artificial uterus will beat us to it. But well, now what do? Now you have pregnancy going on in multiple women. So we have to look at three different models of pregnancy. What is the essence of the process of producing a child, and to what other creative processes might we compare it? One possibility is that we compare it to a plant. meaning you take a seed, you put the seed in the ground, it develops in a helpful medium that contributes to its survival and growth, and ultimately there is a plant. That's one way, that's one possible analogy for pregnancy. The goal of the analogy is to say, well, maybe there are laws or sources or precedents that I can apply in the realm of the analogy that will then be portable, I can bring back here. So maybe there are rules regarding plants in Jewish law that I can now apply. That's one possibility. Second possibility, a fetus is like a manufactured product. Fashioned by the mother's womb. In other words, the mother is taking raw materials and creating a human being out of them. Third possibility, a fetus is just a cell that matures within a particular environment. The fetus starts out not a cell, it's really a zygote, right? If it's one cell, it's not anything yet. We could talk about cloning some other time. The fetus is fundamentally a zygote that matures inside of a particular environment to grow into a human being. Each of these different views is going to lead us to different conclusions about what the mother's essential contribution is, and therefore who is actually the mother. Let's go back approach by approach. The first approach that we mentioned is the idea that the fetus is a plant. Rabbi Zev Levin Israel, Rabbi Ezra Bick, put forth this idea. Rabbi Bick makes a fascinating point in source number 13. He talks about rabbinic literature going back a couple of thousand years ago and how it understood what happens when a fetus develops. Well, first of all, what fertilization is, and then where things go from there. And he makes an interesting argument. Not everybody agrees with the following statement, the statement he's going to make. But look at what he says. There is, however, no clear source in rabbinic literature which suggests that a woman has ova, has eggs. Now again, that's a little bit contentious, because the Talmud has a line, and in fact there's a biblical verse that talks about a woman being mazri'a, right? Isha ki tazri'a, for those who are familiar with the line from Leviticus. The Talmud talks about isha mazrat. Zera means what in Hebrew? Seed. So it sounds like the woman does have something that they're recognizing as a contribution towards the creation of the zygote and ultimately the embryo. But Rabbi Bick shows that commentators did not always take the word mazria and tazria in that way, and suggests that actually they didn't think that that was what was going on. That the way they looked at it, scientifically inaccurate, but the way that they looked at it was that the material contribution is coming from the male. It then enters into the woman, much like a seed going into the ground. And that's not meant to be insulting. It really isn't. That was a scientific understanding of what was going on. It's not the Jews alone who lived in an ancient world that didn't have the ability to identify eggs. But inasmuch as the rabbi certainly had a concept of motherhood, he says, such a concept must be definable without reference to the ovum. This in and of itself might argue for birth as the sole determining factor for motherhood. That's along the way to getting to his conclusion. He says, however, there is another conceptual model of parenthood, one based on the model of fertilization rather than donation and combination. Don't look at it as he provides material, she provides material, they combine, and that's what creates the new life. But rather look at it as the father being the one who puts in the initial material, and then the mother being the one who grows it into a life. This model perceives the role of father and mother as essentially parallel to what takes place in agriculture, where a seed is placed in a fertile environment. That would be the idea. So in that case, the key element of the mother is that she is the one who brings the child along. It's not about contribution of genetic material. Here's an interesting note. If you take a look at source number 14, a paper called Gestation, Work for Hire or the Essence of Motherhood from the Duke Journal of Gender Law and Policy, dealing with the question of surrogacy, the rights of a surrogate, how you view the role of a surrogate and what her stake is in the child that she has just brought to term. So Pamela Laufer-Eucalies looks at this in Jewish law. And she says, the majority opinion in Jewish law, she thinks, is that gestation is the defining characteristic of motherhood. I say she thinks because defining majority opinions in Jewish law is not so easy. But she says, a moving target, but she says gestation is the defining characteristic of motherhood. Defining motherhood by that which is unique to mothers, as discussed by Rabbi Engel, I'm not bringing in Rabbi Engel in this, more explicitly by Rabbi Bick, is based on the Jewish law recognition of differences between men and women. Meaning, if you're stuck on the idea that you become a father by providing sperm and you become a mother by providing an egg, what you're really trying to do is to say men and women are all the same. We each contribute genetic material and that's what leads to the baby. And she says that's an anti-feminist approach. I'm not an expert, but that's what she said. She says, no. The father is, yes, the father can only be identified based on the genetic material he provides, because that's his role, and then hopefully he's being supportive, but, you know, that's all he really can do until he's supposed to be waking up in the middle of the night to be the one to take care of the feeding. Change the diapers and so on. But there's a long period in between there where, you know, he's basically watching. The mother, on the other hand, she argues, should not be defined based on contribution of an egg. The maternity is carrying this child to term. That's the argument that he makes, and therefore, within that approach, the argument would be the true mother is the gestational mother. In the case that we brought before, so argues Rabbi Bick, so argue a few others, the case that we brought before, Sarah's DNA, Rebecca's mitochondria, Rachel's uterus, Rachel is the mother. If you compare pregnancy to growing a plant, that's one approach. Second approach, the fetus is a manufactured product fashioned by the mother's womb, meaning the fetus is fundamentally implanted in the uterus, right? Living there, inside the mother, as part of the mother's body. It is growing. It is developing. God willing, all goes well. At the end, you have a finished product which emerges and is able to live independently another 20 years or 25 years down the line. Allowing for the fact that it seems gestation continues outside the womb already without the benefit of modern technology. The traditional sources in Judaism do seem to support this idea that, in fact, the child is considered to be part of the mother until birth. A classic example of this is source number 15. You may be familiar with the principle that says that when somebody converts to Judaism, they are a new person. You ever hear that phrase? Yeah. They're considered to be a new person in Jewish law. So, for example, all of their relationships that they previously had are severed in terms of Jewish, as far as Jewish law is concerned. So that you could have the case that, in fact, we're going to be discussing, which is, you have two brothers. Well, first, before we get to the case we're going to discuss, you have two brothers. Need to do this a better way. We'll deal with the case here. Jewish law says that a Jewish man is not allowed to marry his brother's ex-wife. Right? Unless you're dealing with the levirate marriage Yibum case, one of them died without children, that's not our discussion. Normally, there are two brothers, Reuven and Shimon. Reuven is married. Reuven gets divorced. Shimon, his brother, is not allowed to marry his ex. It's also a bad idea, family dinners and the like. You don't want to go there. But what we're saying is, from a Jewish law perspective, you don't do that. Okay. However, if Reuven and Shimon were not Jewish, first, don't ask me how they got those names. Reuven and Shimon were not Jewish. They then converted to Judaism.
Reuven, at that point, is no longer Shimon's brother, halachically. And therefore, if Reuven gets married, and then the marriage ends, after the conversion, Reuven gets married, and then the marriage ends, Shimon is now able to marry Reuven's divorcee. They are not considered brothers in the eyes of Jewish law. When you convert to Judaism, you gain a brand new family. The Jewish people are your family, and all the biological connections that you had are severed. That does not mean, very careful, that does not mean that a person who converts does not honor their biological parents. It does not mean that they don't mourn for them. That's not at all what we're saying. The issue of how relationships continue after conversion is a fascinating one, but way beyond the scope of what we're going to be able to get to this morning. The point, though, for our purposes is twin brothers convert. They don't have to be twins, but they do for the case we're about to see. Twin brothers convert. They are no longer brothers in the eyes of Jewish law. Clear? Understood? Okay. Yes?
Why did you specify twins?
Because of where we're going. Take a look at number 15. No, you'll see. We didn't need to until now, but because of where we're going. If twin brothers convert, or they had been slaves and they were freed, one would not be liable for relations with his brother's wife. Meaning, if they're still married, he's going to be liable. She's a married woman. Bad idea. No, what we're talking about here is the case I just gave. His brother got divorced. After that, the other brother takes up with her. He's not liable. It's not his brother's wife. If they were conceived before their mother became Jewish, okay? So in other words, there is a woman who is pregnant with twins. Normally, if a woman converts to Judaism while she is pregnant, the child is born Jewish. So now, if the twins were conceived before the mother became Jewish, but they were born once their mother was Jewish, their mother converted while pregnant with the twins, then one would be liable for relations with his brother's wife. In other words, they are considered brothers in the eyes of Jewish law because at the moment of birth, they were born to a Jewish mother. So the argument goes as follows. Since you're telling me that their identity is based on who their mother was at the time of birth and not who their mother was at the time of conception, that proves that the maternal identity is with birth. It's not about who donated the eggs. The woman who donated the egg in this case was not Jewish. However, the woman who birthed them is Jewish. Happens to be the same person. But that's one source that is brought to make the argument that, in fact, it's birth that does it. Another source that's brought for it goes back to the book of Esther. The book of Esther introduces us to Esther saying, "Ki ein la av va'ein." She had neither father nor mother. When her father and mother died, Mordechai had actually adopted her. Right? If you remember the story from the book of Esther, Mordechai has adopted Esther, then he hands her off to the first king he can find. No, the text, though, as brought in number 16 from the Talmud, has a redundancy in it. It says, she had neither father nor mother, and when her father and mother died. And the Talmud says, you didn't need all of these words. You must be trying to teach me something. What is it trying to teach me? Rav Acha said, not that her father and mother died when she was 3 years old, 5 years old, 15 years old, but rather, upon conception, her father died, and upon birth, her mother died. In other words, she never had. It isn't just that her father and mother died at some point. She never knew her father and mother. Her father died before she was born. Her mother died right after she was born. That's the way that the Talmud understands this picture. Now, you'll tell me, though, she still had a father and mother, right? Her mother gave birth to her. She died in childbirth, is the way the Talmud reads it. So some look at this and say, she never had a mother, as the line goes here, because it's only birth that actually identifies the mother as the mother, and the mother did not survive childbirth. She died in childbirth, and therefore there was no mother. Birth is a determinant. If you're looking at that and thinking, that's awfully flimsy as a source, you ain't seen nothing yet. This is the best one. This is one which I only bring because it gets a lot of airtime, so to speak, in the debates about this issue. But everyone who looks at this says, this can't be the basis for determining Jewish law. Having said that, Jacob is married to four women, right? Rachel, well, in order, Leah, and then Rachel, and then Bilhah, and then Zilpah. Leah produces six sons and one daughter, right? Remember that? She produced six sons and one daughter. Rachel, who was the one who had been the beloved and intended wife and so on, produces two sons. If you remember the way the biblical text describes it, Leah is actually pregnant for her seventh time, and Rachel does not yet have a child. That seventh child turns out to be the daughter, Dinah. Rachel then produces her son, Joseph. The Talmud looks at some of the language there when Dinah is born. And we're not going into all of the language now, the whole analysis is simply too big for right now. But the Talmud says the following happened. Leah has some kind of prophecy and knows that Jacob is going to have 12 sons. How does she know? Prophecy. Leah is a prophet. She knows that there are going to be 12 sons. And she does the math. And she says, I already have six. Bilhah and Zilpah each have two. That means the maximum Rachel can produce is two. Right? Six, two, two, and two. However, if the seventh pregnancy ends in the birth of another boy for Leah, then Rachel isn't going to rank at all. She'll be, at most, the mother of one. And so Leah prays to God, and as it's usually read in the Midrash, there's actually a change of gender. That it's supposed to be Joseph, it's going to be Joseph, and instead it becomes Dinah. First case in recorded history. Done in utero, I might add. Truly remarkable. That's the usual read. However, there is an ancient Aramaic commentary to the Torah which took the story differently. Take a look, please, at source number 17. It's called Targum Yonatan. Authorship is a fascinating discussion, not for right now. And God heard the prayers of Leah, and the fetuses were switched in their wombs. Joseph was placed into the womb of Rachel, and Dinah into the womb of Leah. Leave aside whether this is meant to be taken literally or not. It's not the point for the purpose of our conversation. Whether this is meant to be literal or not doesn't matter for the purposes of this conversation. The idea is that Joseph was really the egg of... Joseph was the egg of Leah. Dinah was the egg of Rachel. But classically, we always take Joseph as the son of Rachel, the son of the woman who carried him to term. Whether this is intended literally or not is not the point. The point is that they have no problem saying that you could have a child born from the egg of one woman, but carried to term in another woman, and identified as the child of that second woman. Now, those in the rabbinic field who write about this and don't like this say there are all sorts of reasons not to go with this point, not to go with this view. But it's such a great source, you know? I mean, the whole idea of the swapping and all that, wow, it's mind-blowing. That's the idea. Rabbi J. David Bleich makes the argument that the consensus, in fact, is the woman who gives birth is the one who is the mother. Take a look at number 18. Although there is a minority view that regards the donor mother as the sole mother of a child born of IVF, the consensus of rabbinic opinion, another loaded phrase, is that a maternal filial relationship is generated between the gestational mother and the child, despite the absence of any genetic relationship, by virtue of parturition, of birth alone. That, he says, is the consensus. And then he goes on to say, but maybe you could have more than one mother. Maybe the genetic one is also the mother. And indeed, you could have that possibility because Rabbi Blyth believes you could have more than one mother. So we have two views so far. View number one says it's like growing a plant. There's a seed inside the... And the seed is developed by the mother. And according to that view, it's really gestation that's going to be what matters. Okay, because that's the mother's contribution. The second view is that the fetus is a manufactured product and it's birth. When the child separates from the mother, that's the moment that matters and what determines motherhood. And then you have the third view. And the third view is to say the fetus is simply a zygote that matures inside of the space, inside of the mother, and that's all that really matters. And therefore, the provider of the genetic material is going to be the mother. And even though we saw Rabbi Bick contend that the mother isn't providing ova in the eyes of rabbinic writing, there is, as I pointed out, rabbinic writing and even biblical writing that suggests the recognition that yes, she is providing genetic material. I brought you one passage in the Talmud in source number 19, which says there are three partners in a person: God, the Father, and the mother. And commenting on that, Rabbi Itamar Warhaftig in source number 20 says the following: it appears logical to me that a parent from whom an egg is taken is more likely to be considered the mother. The child is born from a blend of the father's seed and the mother's egg, and they impact his traits. And he quotes that passage in the Talmud in number 19. The fetal development in the womb of the mother is only the place where it grows. Today, part of this process can be done in a lab. Even if we will say that the contribution of a mother developing it in her womb is better than that of a lab, still, it would only be adding to the seed which has been formed in conception. He says, as far as I'm concerned, it's the genetic material that matters, and therefore the donor of the egg is the one who counts. That's his view. Okay. So now we have three different views, right? Pregnancy is like the seed, in which case gestation is what matters. There are many sources in this that I just didn't bring. I told you in the beginning because of time. There are many more sources that could have been brought on each of these three paths. But one is that it's like a seed growing. The second view is that it's like a manufactured product. And birth, when it separates from the mother, now it's a finished product. That's what matters. And then the third view, which is the zygote initially, whatever contributed to the zygote, that's really what matters. It's just a zygote that evolved. That's the way to look at the pregnancy process. And in fact, that's the position of Rabbi Asher Weiss, who I mentioned before. He was talking about the artificial uterus in context, and he said the artificial uterus changes nothing. The mother is the one who provides the egg. However, we have to go back to our three mother problem. Even if you're going to take the view that it's the egg donor, what do you do when it includes mitochondria from somebody else? How are we going to balance that? How are we going to deal with that? So, there are multiple schools. Surprise. School number one, and this is the argument of Rabbi Weiss, is that mitochondrial DNA is a tiny minority of the DNA in that cell. Right? I showed you in the beginning, in source number one, when I gave you the quick digest of the science from Rabbi Blyth, was it there that we said how many? 37. I'm not seeing it right now, but I trust you that it was there. You had a really a minuscule amount of DNA in the mitochondria compared to what you have in the general material. So take a look at source number 21, my translation of what Rabbi Weiss argues. He says, still it appears that in our case, when the great majority of the genetic material is found in the nucleus of the Jewish mother's egg, and only about 1/1000th of it is found in the portion taken from the non-Jewish donor. He's talking about where the mitochondria come from someone who is not Jewish. So he says, the nucleus has way more genetic material than the mitochondria. It is certainly logical to follow the majority and the essence, and the child is Jewish for all purposes. That is his argument. Although there is room to argue, and say that if we would truly compare cases, then regarding nullification in the majority, well, let me say it outside, they'll be clearer than reading it in his text. He's arguing for what we call, in rabbinic language, bitul berov, nullifying something in the majority. It's a principle that comes up in many areas of law. For example, you have a Sanhedrin, you have a court, and the court is judging a case. Minority says X, majority says Y. The Torah says, "Acharei rabim lahatot," you follow the majority. Kashrut, right? We have the idea that if non-kosher makes it into a mixture, depending on the circumstances, it may be nullified in the majority of the mixture. What the ratio is depends on what happened. 1/60th minority, that's its own discussion, but the point is, we have a principle that you nullify the minority and the majority. So he says, the mitochondrial DNA of the minority compared to the DNA as a whole, therefore it is nullified. He notes, though, that one might have objections. Objection number one is that in kashrut we say, if you can taste the minority in the mixture, it's not nullified. Right? You don't have the right to say, it doesn't matter if you can taste it when it's there. So he says, the mitochondrial DNA are what are enabling each cell in the body to produce energy. Maybe the argument should be that they cannot be nullified. Further, another principle, a davar ha-ma'amid, that which stabilizes a mixture, enabling it to exist, cannot be nullified. Because again, its impact on the whole is noticeable. You can actually see it. So the argument goes that maybe it should not be nullified. He disagrees. He says it's simply not true. And he says, in his last line, the line that we already saw him say in an earlier source, he says, I'm not really arguing about minority, majority. It's not really that I believe in nullification of the mitochondrial DNA. My real point is that I don't believe that there can be more than one halachic mother. He believes that there's only one. And if I have to choose between the producer of the egg and the provider of the mitochondria, the egg donor is going to win. That's really his argument. It's a logic argument. It's not a source-based, text-based argument. That's one school of thought. However, I'm sorry, and a second argument in favor of that comes from Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg. Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg is a brilliant, brilliant both rabbi and pediatric neurosurgeon in Israel today. He is a leading authority on Jewish law, as well as specifically Jewish medical ethics. He speaks in Toronto from time to time. He comes in for medical conferences. Just an absolutely stunning thinker. And also creative. He spoke at the convention of the Rabbinical Council of America last month. And one of the questions he addressed was the mitochondrial DNA question. And he made a point which once I heard it on the recording, I wasn't there, but once I heard the recording, I said, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And it hadn't dawned on me at all. This whole mitochondrial DNA discussion may well be a red herring. Right? Why? Why would it be, if you didn't read source number 22 yet, why would this be a red herring? A red herring. That's a technical term. Early.
Because if you're implanting an egg, you're going to implant a good egg. You're not going to implant one. Knowing that you need to also implant mitochondria.
Well, in that case, I don't have any problem, because then I'm not using the mitochondria. But no, they're implanting eggs with the mitochondria. They are doing that with the mitochondria of another woman. They're doing it. It exists. Take a look at source number 22. He says, the function of the mitochondria is to supply... This is just I directly took it from the audio, so it reads like somebody speaking, not like somebody writing. The mitochondria. The function of the mitochondria is to supply energy to the cell, to function. It has nothing to do with the DNA that creates the human being, that is part of the creation of the human being, right? Your eyes, your everything, right? It doesn't come from the mitochondrial DNA. Would we say that if someone gets a heart transplant, the donor is his father? Right? It's a part of the body that is supporting life, but it doesn't determine who you are. Parenthood goes only by the DNA that has to do with the creation of the human being. It makes so much sense, doesn't it? And once you read it, you're like, oh, yeah, that's true. However, that only is going to win if you believe that genetic material is what does it. That only works surprised if you believe that genetic material is the determining factor. What if, in fact, you don't go with genetic material? You go instead with the idea of gestation or with more than one mother. So Rabbi Bleich, in source number 23, says no. He says you can't make the majority argument that Rabbi Usher Weiss made for the reasons we already said. He doesn't think that the idea of nullifying it in the mixture works because the mitochondrial DNA have a noticeable effect. They keep the creature going and so on. And he says, I believe in having multiple mothers, and therefore he is more apt to say, count all of them as the mothers of the child. I don't know what he would respond to Rabbi Dr. Steinberg. I don't know his response to that. But I want to summarize where we've been. Okay? We got 28 seconds. Our question was this. New technology enables replacing a necessary part of the egg with tissue from another woman. This is going on, at least in Israel, and there are certain other countries that license it, even if Canada does not yet. So who is going to be the mother? Assuming you go ahead with this, with not everybody agrees that we want to do that. But if you do, so who is going to be the mother? So we noted that there's debate about whether you can have multiple mothers, with some saying, as Rabbi Weiss says, that's completely illogical, no such thing. And others arguing, no, we have precedent. The story of Goliath shows the rabbis accepting the idea of multiple fathers. So too there can be multiple mothers. And we have the argument about whether you could say there's no halachic mother at all, which is not a source-based discussion, but just a logic one. Rabbi Waldenberg having said, you could say no one is considered the mother if they don't do the entire process. It's all or nothing. And others arguing, as Rabbi Bleich does, that that's simply not a logical conclusion. We articulated three models of pregnancy, each one based on Jewish tradition. In terms of thinking about who the mother is, whether you say that the fetus is a plant and the mother is the one who is growing it, and therefore it's gestation that matters, whether the fetus is a manufactured product separating from the mother at birth, and that's what the birth is what actually generates it, like the case of the twins and the other sources that we brought, or whether we say the fetus is a zygote that matures, the mother is the one who provides the female genetic material for that zygote, and therefore the donor of the genetic material is the mother. And again, Rabbi Weiss and Rabbi Dr. Steinberg both say it's not the mitochondria donor, it's the egg donor. And Rabbi Bleich is less sure and wants to consider the possibility of going with multiple. I'm going to try for the next 3 weeks to make sure that the material allows for us to have more questions and discussion, because this is a lot of talking. And I apologize, but hopefully it was still useful. Thank you very much. Please note again...